This is 01-1136-CR State versus Carlson. And Mr. Miller, you represent Mr. Carlson and are the petitioner here.
Yes, my name is Steve Miller and I do represent the defendant in this case, Mr. Carlson. Counsel, members of the court. There's the first two issues I'd like to address in this case because I'm not sure that they were, frankly, adequately emphasized in the briefs. First of all, I don't believe this is strictly a post-verdict case, a post-conviction case. Secondly, I would like to talk a little bit more about the standard of review in this case, given that this is a constitutional determination. I think clearly the ultimate standard of review in this case is de novo. First, not a post-verdict case. In this case, the trial court was clearly put on notice that there was a problem. The jury sent a note to the judge asking the trial court to talk to this juror. His name was Tony, asking him to talk to Tony, evaluate the situation because, quote, he does not understand the trial proceedings. The jury also made reference to a section of the juror handbook which covered juror qualifications and which included English language competence, among other things. One of the possibilities specifically discussed by the trial court was whether Tony had an English language problem. In at least two points in the record, the trial judge makes reference to the possibility that that's what is going on. The trial court even asked counsel if they had copies of the jury questionnaires because the trial court knew that the questionnaires contained the question about English language competence, and they would be able to review the questionnaire to see if anything had been raised.
Mr. Miller, are these references in the trial record before the jurors send out the note to the judge?
No, it's in response to the note.
Okay. Was the first time the judge knew about the problem when the jury asked
the judge to evaluate
the first time? That was mid-trial. It was after trial. It was in jury deliberations.
This was correct. This was during the deliberations that the note was sent out, which I would add that in United States versus Tanner, which is one of the cases the state is relying on in this case, that court specifically discusses a situation similar to this and cites that as one of the quote safeguards of the system, that in fact 606B, the federal equivalent of our 90606, does not cover that situation, and it cites that as an example of one of the safeguards for preventing incompetent jurors, and I can give you a page number on that too in a minute. In addition to that, the trial counsel preserved this issue by asking for a mistrial. Trial counsel asked for a mistrial, arguing that there was no happy solution to this problem. Trial counsel indicated that on the one hand, an inquiry may very well be necessary, but trial counsel also pointed out that there were some risks involved, that bringing the juror out, depending on what the problem was, which nobody was sure at that point, that bringing the juror out could possibly put pressure on the juror to change his vote. Trial counsel was simply making an argument for his motion for mistrial, that there was really no good way to handle this. This was not, as I think the state suggests in one of its briefs, a strategic decision by counsel to let this case go to a jury verdict with this jury. I think that argument is inconsistent with what trial counsel was asking for here, which was a mistrial, which is, as we all know, would result in a new trial with new jurors. So I think it would be difficult to argue that what trial counsel strategy was here was to let this jury go to verdict. And also, I would add that the trial counsel specifically testified that there was no strategic consideration as well. I think at that point, the trial court was on notice, and at that point, either should have granted the mistrial or brought the juror out for voir dire and made, I think, the findings that are required by State versus Turner, Wisconsin case, and State versus Hampton. As I think Justice Sykes well know, that was she was trial court in that case. That case was remanded for trial court determinations to find out what testimony was missed, whether that testimony was material, and for a determination whether or not there was prejudice. I think at that point, the trial court, had it not granted the motion for mistrial, I think had an obligation to make those findings. I did cite a New Mexico case in the brief, State versus Escamilla, 760 P. Second 1276. That case holds that the trial court fundamentally errs if, after receiving a note from the jury stating that a particular juror did not understand English, that it does not conduct a summary hearing and determine for itself whether or not the juror understands English. I think part of the underlying issue, of course, in this case is the question of, you know, what is a proper constitutional standard for English fluency. A lot of what is being discussed in this case, however, is the question of how do you prove it, particularly the impact of 90606 on this case. And I would just say that in conjunction with my argument that I think this is, in many ways, a pre-verdict case rather than simply a post-verdict inquiry, that I think clearly United States versus Tanner and 90606 are not relevant to a pre-verdict situation.
So what are the standards? How low can we go, or what should the standard be?
I'm sorry?
What are the standards? How low should we go, or can we, or what should the trial court have done? Whether he had a hearing, he determined based on the hearing that that this was sufficient. You're saying that it was not, obviously, and what should the trial judge have done other than grant a mistrial? Could he have talked? You know, you made the defense counsel said no, he didn't want him to talk to him. What else could the judge have done at that point?
I would disagree with that characterization. I think what the trial counsel said was that you can bring him out, but there's a risk that there was a long discussion about what to do. There was a lot of discussions about what the options were, and trial counsel simply pointed out the fact, I think, that maybe the judge did need to bring him out, but on the other hand, there was a risk to bring him out, and therefore the solution should be a mistrial. That was the argument that trial counsel was making. Now, I think trial counsel should have made the alternative argument that you should bring him out. If you're not going to grant my mistrial, you should bring him out. And I argue that as a grounds for ineffective assistance of counsel in the alternative. But I don't see trial counsel in the record telling the judge not to bring him out. That's not how I interpret that exchange. I think that if you
could you point me to that in the we have that in front of us?
Yes. That would have been on page 654 to 658. Particularly 657.
Which would have been in the appendix, what?
That would be in the trial. That's in the trial transcript, not the post-conviction transcript. That's on 98. That's record number 98.
At this point, counsel, we're past the point of reviewing a discretionary judgment of a circuit court not to grant a mistrial, and in any event, the standard of review on that is highly deferential. So perhaps you could address yourself to the legal question in the case about what standard of ESL competency there should be for a juror to be found competent to sit, if English is the second language for the juror.
Okay. I do think the evidence that we can look at, of course, in order to determine that question is important. And I do think that, the evidence is fairly compelling. But in any event, the question of English competence comes, first of all, from State versus Tanner and State versus Hampton, which discuss one was a hearing impaired juror case, and the other one was a sleeping juror case. And in both of those cases, the Court of Appeal, these are both Court of Appeals cases, stated a number of constitutional rights, impartiality, competency, unanimity, among others, required that jurors comprehend testimony, that they be able to comprehend the material testimony. Those were the findings that the trial court was required to make, that material testimony was not missed. And I think that term, comprehend testimony, I think is a good term also to use in the context of a non-English-speaking juror. Did the non-English-speaking juror comprehend the testimony? I think there's also the in State versus Coble, which is an older case. I'm citing the concurrence in that case, where there's a paragraph in the brief where I can't remember which justice is discussing the fact that jurors are need to speak and need to understand more than a minimum, have more than a minimum understanding of the English language. Also, I think I did cite another case, State versus Gallegos, a New Mexico case, a juror has to have enough knowledge of English to be able to understand the issues and evaluate the evidence and arrive at an independent judgment.
Well, isn't that within the Court of Appeals standard of sufficiently to fairly and competently try the case?
Well, I think to honestly answer your question, yes. However, I think that standard is just too vague and too broad to be of any help to the trial court.
Well, the standard I got was yours, if I got it right, substantially comprehend trial testimony. Is that your standard?
I'm not particular whether we use substantial comprehension or comprehension. I know the state was trying to make a distinction with that. I don't logically see
material distinction. Well, what's the difference between comprehend trial testimony and fairly and competently try the case?
I think that's all true. I think the juror has to fairly and competently try the case, but it's one of those My objection to that standard is that it's kind of begs the question. What is in fact? I think you have to look at the juror's duties and try to attach the standard, make the standard somewhat commensurate.
Your brief gives ACTFL guidelines.
Yes.
But there's no evidence. He was never subjected to these guidelines. The trial court didn't have them.
No.
This is after the fact.
Right.
Are you suggesting that all jurors be given these and that every juror get with whatever range you think is thought for comprehension?
In the ideal world, yes. My primary goal, however, with presenting that to you is it more of an educative function to show what I think was the primary problem in this case was simply a lack of appreciation for the difference between a juror who understands some English, you know, what the linguists call survival English, and a juror that is able to understand narrative testimony, and the huge gap that exists between those two abilities and those two levels. And simply what I'm trying to do with that is illustrate that there is a huge gap between those two abilities and that there are many shades of ability in terms of fluency. I think anybody who's tried to learn a language understands that implicitly.
Well, we're going to have to write. Someone here is going to have to write an opinion. We're going to have to say to the trial court, if you have to gauge a juror in terms of understanding English, here's the standard you apply. Then we're going to have to say, let's look at the facts of this case. And there we may have a standard or a review issue, but the trial judge made findings. And usually, even if it's constitutional fact, we will support those. And then we make an ultimate determination, you view it as constitutional, of whether the facts fit the standard, right?
Right.
Okay. So first, if I can, what do I write? Here's your big chance to write the opinions you plan. What do I write as the standard that the trial judge should look to?
The standard is that the juror has to be sufficiently competent in English to comprehend narrative testimony.
Okay. Comprehend what testimony?
Narrative testimony.
Narrative testimony, right. Okay. Now, the next issue then in this case, I think, is how do you prove it? And was it proved here? So, here we have, I'm going to recite the fact, you tell me if it's good enough, and then we'll look at it as a whole. Vera passed a written test in English to get his driver's license.
Correct.
Does that persuade you that he's sufficiently competent to comprehend the narrative testimony?
No.
But it's one little bit.
I think it's evidence of survival English. Apart from the fact that you have to make a lot of assumptions as to what that actually entails, it simply does not mean that a person can listen to a story at length and evaluate it. We're still worlds apart.
Okay. He passed his citizenship test, which included one oral and one written question in English.
We don't know what that test is. I mean, and my understanding of that test...
I bet we could get it from the net, from the internet.
I'm sorry?
We could get it from the internet.
Yeah. Well, possibly.
Public document?
I mean, those are well-rehearsed. It's like a driver's license. All of those are fairly well-rehearsed events.
Well, he also had to have an oral examination, so he had to speak. Doesn't require that he speak. Not only requires he understands, but when he's speaking, he had to understand the question.
Right.
Okay. You think that's rehearsed, too?
Yes.
Okay. He took an oath in the courtroom, and he responded appropriately.
I don't know.
Do you think everybody
what that
says
proves.
I do?
Even the prosecutor admitted that, well, he's been in court before. He watched how many witnesses do it. It's a one-word answer.
He
doesn't show real comprehension.
He was asked to leave the courtroom, and he responded appropriately.
Yes.
You think that shows comprehension?
I don't think that addresses narrative comprehension either. We had I was there, and I can't testify as a witness here, but there was a lot of gesticulating and looking, and it was a fairly simple command. I mean, I'm not saying the guy speaks no English, but whether he can understand a narrative testimony, I think, is the issue. And my point is that if you look at the kinds of evidence, questions that would illustrate a narrative understanding, he fails.
Well, he took the witness stand and he responded to questions without an interpreter, even though he had difficulty, I gather, understanding all the questions he was asked.
Correct.
What does that show you?
That shows me he's deficient. He should have understood all the questions that were asked. There were many questions he didn't understand, and many of the questions that were asked were questions of leading questions of fairly simple personal knowledge.
Well, what evidence have I left out that you think we should consider or the trial court should consider?
You mean in terms of his own testimony or in general?
All of the testimony that was admitted, then we'll get to the one testimony that wasn't admitted.
Okay, well, we have obviously his own self-assessment. The juror form that he signed stating that he did not understand English.
I know, but I filled out forms and I mark the wrong box sometimes.
He told the lady bailiff that he didn't speak English when the jury was called up, and she told him to sit down and listen. He didn't understand a juror when he was asked if he wanted a cigarette when the jurors went out to smoke. The jury sent a note saying that he does not comprehend the proceedings. His immediate work supervisor, I mean, this is the most convincing witness in my view, is his immediate work supervisor and his only English-speaking friend made very clear that his English was extremely deficient.
What about his inability to order dinner with the jurors?
His ability to what?
His inability to order dinner with the jurors.
Well,
I'll have what he's had.
Well, I think that is pretty amazing. He can't order a sub sandwich, although,
The problem I have with all this is that this is an intensely fact-driven inquiry that we're not supposed to be engaging in as an appellate court. That's what the trial court's to do. We defer to those findings unless you're asking us to find as a matter of law that somebody who has these characteristics doesn't make the grade. Well, otherwise, we have to set the standard and decide whether the circuit court applied an appropriate standard or whether there's a different one, and send it back. We can't overturn those factual findings or say that they're not enough unless we find as a matter of law that they're not enough, which would be an unusual thing to do.
Right, and that may be a matter of perspective. In my view, you know, the evidence is not only overwhelming, but it's corroborated in every respect. But I do think, though, the primary problem here is that there was no legal standard applied. There was, I don't think there was any legal standard, real legal standard applied by the trial court. Certainly there was not a legal standard that I'm proposing that I think was necessary to meet constitutional standards. You know, that would be to comprehend testimony. The Court of Appeals cited a standard that the trial court applied, but that wasn't what, in fact, it did. Those words never came out of the trial court's mouth. In fact, the trial court indicates in its decision that it's reluctant to apply a standard. It states in several points that it shouldn't do so.
Mr. Miller, is it beyond dispute that an objection was not waived by trial counsel?
Well, that you'll have to address to the state's attorney. I think that certainly a mistrial was made, and depending on how you interpret that exchange, I don't believe it was waived. Whether it's beyond dispute that it was waived, then we may get into an ineffective assistance of counsel alternative argument in that regard. I don't think it was waived. I think if you read the record fairly and look at what was going on, the exchange that was going on between the trial court and trial counsel was simply making an argument for mistrial. Trial counsel saying that there's no good solution here. If you bring them out, you probably need to bring them out to find out what's going on, but if you do bring them out, then you're going to put the spotlight on him and maybe put pressure on his vote, whatever it may be. And so there's simply no good solution here. I don't interpret that as a waiver. And certainly it's a waiver would be inconsistent, I think, with the motion for mistrial.
Why didn't trial counsel, if I understand the case, look at the juror questionnaire?
Trial counsel did not look at the jury questionnaires.
Why?
Just didn't do it. I did ask him about that at the post-conviction hearing, and I think it was out of county. He was an out of county trial counsel, and in the rush of getting ready for trial, I think he just simply failed to do it.
You would not make an argument that trial counsel was relying on some vocal practice of whenever someone strikes the box, they don't understand English? Or what was the local practice?
That was the local practice, that if somebody strikes the box, checks the box no, then they're just not put on the jury in the jury pool. They're not put into the computer. That's it. And the clerk testified to that.
Well, isn't the standard that the trial court used the court was called upon to measure what is a sufficient understanding of the English language to allow a person to participate in jury deliberations? And then another time the trial court said, did he have sufficient understanding of the English language to allow him to participate as a juror in our system?
Right. Yes, that is correct. But
for the same reasons, even I think that's even broader and even bigger than the standard proposed by the Court of Appeals, and that it just simply doesn't address the issue of what level of English comprehension is necessary to participate and fairly try a case to be competent. I think what I'm asking the court to do is to set a standard that has some basis in the reality of what a juror has to do, and to make sure that the trial court understands that the juror has to be able to understand witnesses and able to understand. I think it should be obvious, I think, but I don't know. I think if you look at the, if you read the decision from Judge Warpinski, he is very reluctant to exclude jurors.
Now, is the part of the record, I'm looking at the record trying to find, you said record number 98?
That was the last day of trial.
Is that up here? I mean, it came up?
Yes.
All right, thank you, counsel. Ms. Bray, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lee Prey, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the state. I think what we need to start out with here is the factual findings that the trial court made, and this was a factual finding that that the juror under contention, Juror Vera, had sufficient understanding of the English language to serve as a juror in our system. And it's the state's position that that factual finding was not clearly erroneous, and that is the proper standard that should be applied in reviewing this issue. The consideration of whether somebody has an appropriate level of English comprehension to serve in our jury system is a very fact-based kind of decision, as Justice Sykes said. It's similar to a decision that courts make if a defendant is competent to stand trial, which under Burge is the clearly erroneous and standard of fact-based decision. It's similar to deciding whether a person is subjectively biased so that they are not appropriate to be on the jury. That, again, is such a fact-based decision that this court has found that the standard for reviewing that is clearly erroneous.
And so let me pick up on that, because you used the word appropriate, which I always think is such a nebulous word. You use that with reference to the juror question. What if the standard was, rather than, as you assert, had sufficient understanding to serve as a juror in our system, had appropriate understanding to serve as a juror in our system?
I don't know what the difference between sufficient and appropriate is. Appropriate to me has some connotation that some understanding is good and some is bad, and so I don't quite understand that.
Well, you don't sufficiently or appropriately understand where I'm going probably with this. Both of those seem to me to beg the question. If I said, had appropriate understanding, my response is, okay, what's the standard? What is the appropriate understanding? Much like the standard that you're advancing, that is, had a sufficient understanding to serve as a juror in our system. I say, hey, that begs the question. What
is the sufficient understanding? What is the standard? Not some, for want of a better and more legal phrase, puffball and amorphous appropriate or sufficient, you know. That's what I used to do as a trial court judge. Sometimes I wouldn't know what the burden of proof was. So you say, I make a finding that they've met it to the sufficient and appropriate standard, whatever that is. Don't we have to give more here?
First of all, I think I want to stress that the state is more comfortable with the Court of Appeals phrasing of it, but it still doesn't answer your question, which is a sufficient understanding of English language to fairly and impartially try the case. But that being aside, that still doesn't answer your question on the sufficiency. The state's concern here is that two concerns, really. One is that the standard needs to be deferential towards the trial court because it's such a fact-based decision. Secondly, that the standard is not so high that we lose diversity on our jury pool, which has been a long-standing public policy that we want diverse representative people in the jury pool. And thirdly, that we feel that it's not appropriate, at least post-verdict, post-trial, to tie it to the understanding of the testimony at trial, because that will encourage the parties and the trial court to question jurors in ways that are inadmissible under 90606. So those are the concerns. I think that by saying that you have sufficient English comprehension to fairly try and impartially try a case, that is a good balance between the defendant's trial rights, and he has a right to a we agree that there's a constitutional due process right to a fair, impartial jury. So that, but that also balances that out with, if you get to be much more specific about it, you really impinge upon the diversity standard, and you really take away from the trial court's discretionary decision in these cases. And it's got to be a discretionary decision. The trial court is the only one, if the prospective juror either testifies post-trial, as it did here, or in voir dire, who can look that prospective juror in the face, can understand whether that juror was nervous, and that's perhaps why they didn't appear to be fluently answering, whether they were understanding the questions, whether they appeared to be honestly trying to answer the questions, all those kinds of things. The trial court is in the only position to do that. Mr. Miller was saying, well, I was there, I saw the gesticulations. Well, that just points up to me how inappropriate that kind of consideration is at this appellate level. The trial court was there. The trial court saw whether there were gesticulations. The trial court saw whether the person was following the court's oral directions without direction. You know, to me, on the cold record, it appeared to me that the trial court was trying to test Mr. Vera by saying, giving him some oral directions, come up here, turn around, raise your hand, that sort of thing. So,
the trial judge's conclusion that he understood sufficient,
yes.
Understood sufficient, is based, as I understand this record, is based upon the evidence that was admitted before him, correct?
Yes, and his observations.
And his observations. Now, there was a great deal of evidence, maybe not a great deal, but there was evidence that he ruled inadmissible, correct?
Correct.
And so he didn't take that evidence into account. The evidence about Tony's own testimony that he didn't understand the thing, the evidence from the other jurors that they had to order for him, the evidence from other jurors that he didn't understand when they asked him for a cigarette. The judge didn't take any of that into account.
That's right.
But what if the judge had taken that into account? What if he was wrong in not admitting that evidence? What if he was wrong in interpreting 906.02 and instead had all of that evidence in front of him? What do you think the judge's conclusions then might have been different?
I don't know. I mean, it's because the judge specifically said that he was not considering certain evidence. I cannot guess whether
the
decision would be different.
A preliminary question to ask, whether or not the judge was correct in his 906.02 ruling. Because if he was not, and that evidence should have been in front of him, and he should have considered it, then he may well have been wrong.
This court needs to review whether the evidence was appropriately decided as inadmissible. And it's the state's position that the trial court made the correct decision.
And that's because 906.02 says what?
906.06 doesn't allow a post-verdict for a juror to testify to impeach the verdict. The only exception to that is for extraneous information. The things that it doesn't allow testimony on is what happened in deliberations.
Now, as I understand it, Tony was asked, mm-hmm. This was objected to by the state, sustained by the state, whether he understood what was said at trial.
Whether he understood the trial testimony.
Was he asked what he understood at trial?
No.
He was just asked whether he understood the language.
Because
why does that come within 906.02?
Well,
it sounds to me like, what if he said, do you understand English? Do you understand the English that was spoken at trial? How is that different?
Because it involved, first of all, I don't think if the court had not granted the objection at that point and said that was a fine question, that answer doesn't say anything to me. I didn't understand it. What level of understanding did he have? There would have had to have been further investigation on, you know, what witnesses did you understand? What did you understand of the testimony? And
that he did not understand the witnesses. He stated that he was confused.
And that is inadmissible under the Tanner and a long line of cases that follow Tanner, saying that the person's mental processes, that
this is not a process, this is an understanding, an ability to comprehend. I
don't think that that can...
You've got to convince me that this is somehow connected to what 906.02 gets at.
I think a person...
What that is the reasoning process of the jurors, correct? You know, how they looked at all this evidence. Not whether they understood it, but how they looked once they understood the language, then you can say, okay, now what did you understand that testimony to be? I can't ask that. But did you understand it in the first instance?
I think if you look at, even in, there are other cases in other jurisdictions, but even our case from the Supreme Court, Chilcutt, that says asking persons whether they understand testimony, understand the jury instructions are considered the person's internal workings, mental processes, and are not allowable under.
And you think those questions go to whether or not he understood the language itself, not whether he understood what it meant?
I think the better evidence of whether a person has the sufficient understanding of English in order to serve on a jury is questioning that person and observing how they answer questions, how they follow directions, not asking their self-assessment on whether they understood the trial testimony. I think a person's self-assessment can be changed or not a good standard because that person, first of all, is not maybe feeling that if in this case the verdict was a hard-fought verdict, there was a lot of notes coming out. Well, it would be natural after such a verdict that people would start second-guessing their votes. So the whole concept between behind 90606 and the federal counterpart is to preserve the finality of verdicts, to not allow for harassment of jurors, and to preserve the jury system. Well, if you allowed questioning about what they understood or how they came about their verdict, you would allow for pressure from certain jurors who aren't comfortable with the verdict, pressuring another juror into thinking that they were incompetent or having the person who had some language difficulties second-guessing their own ability to reach a verdict.
Well, tell me why this example is wrong. I understand how to get on the web. I understand how to send email, and I understand how to do a lot of things with my computer. But that's a far cry from understanding how it works. I don't begin to understand how it works. And that, to me, seems somewhat here, the same way. I mean, you know, it's a very subtle distinction that I'm trying to make between, you know, what is understood in terms of the language itself as mm-hmm. opposed to what is understood in terms of the concepts that I don't want to invade the jury.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying, and I don't think I can explain it any better, certainly. But I also think the pure question of, did you understand the trial testimony? First of all, there's case law that says that's an internal matter. But secondly, that gets you nowhere. You'd have to ask more questions in order to really
follow up.
You'd have to have follow-up questions. And that's not allowable because that then does get into what parts of the testimony did you understand and what did you understand that to mean. And
do all those pieces involve, do any of those pieces involve what we're involved with here, whether or not there was a real understanding of the English language?
Yes, yes. At Pellegrini, and I've cited that in my brief, and then Tanner with approval. Tanner was not that case, but with approval cited to Pellegrini saying comprehension of English, understanding of English is an internal matter that's not allowable.
Yeah, I understand the mischief that's possible if you let a prospective juror decide for himself or herself whether they understand English, because if they want to get out, they just say no. But it's my understanding that the practice here of a clerk was that if the jury questionnaire came back with a no, that person was out.
That was the practice. The state is not saying that that's an appropriate practice or that it was a required practice.
Okay, but it was in this jurisdiction.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, and that's Brown County. Is there a trial court rule as such, or is this just the practice?
As far as I know, it's the practice, and there is it's your decision in Coble suggesting that it was okay at that point in time to rely on a juror's self-assessment of their qualifications, and it's because you should err on the side of safety early on and to save judicial resources. And that
okay, sort of thing. And it goes with the other cases we've had that said, you know, if you're in doubt about bias, let it go because you don't want error, etc.
Right.
So, as this is a wind-up to my question, an error was made here in the practice. So why not, in this case, just say, look, he was supposed to have been disqualified. He wasn't. He should have been. This is therefore an invalid trial.
For two reasons. First of all, I don't think there was a violation of the practice. There was no statutory violation because the statute
is made.
And the statute also says shows that they are not statutorily qualified, that they may strike if it shows. And it's our contention, the state's contention, that the answer saying, no, I do not understand English, didn't show that he didn't understand it. It indicated. Okay.
I'm looking at 756.03.
I was looking at 756.049.
Okay.
The clerk shall randomly select names from the department list or master list and strike the name of any person randomly selected whose return juror qualification form shows that that person
the
is
answer,
not.
The no. That just fits my... I was looking for Shaw because I had that in my note, and this makes my point even stronger because I was looking for it, and then I couldn't find it again. Because it says the clerk shall strike. That's mandatory.
It is, but only if the qualification shows, and I don't think you can say that it shows. And then moreover...
So he says he's 92, or he says he's 12. Does that show he's 12? It doesn't show he's 12. He states he's 12. You have to go back and find a birth certificate.
Well, whatever you believe about whether it shows it or not, it's the state's contention that if there was a statutory violation, it was harmless because the trial court then did do a voir dire after the fact and determined that this person had sufficient English so that Vera was statutorily qualified because he did understand English.
What harmless error standard are you applying?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
What harmless error standard are you applying?
The court's new harmless error standard that relied on Nader, which I'm not going to be able to repeat to you, but I think it's that the person's substantial rights have not been harmed, as it is in 808.15 harmless error statute.
Could the motion for mistrial have been granted by the trial judge?
I'm glad you brought that up. I meant to comment on Mr. Miller's suggestion that this issue was not waived. I think there's two things going on. First, it was even if that motion for mistrial hadn't been kind of retrieved and he hadn't acquitted.
Who
acquiesce in the court not bringing out the juror to question after trial. That was untimely. It's longstanding law in this state that objections to the qualifications of a juror have to be made before that juror is impaneled. And in this case, there were opportunities for the counsel to determine that there was a potential problem here. If he had asked for the juror qualification form, if he had asked any specific questions to each of the jurors, I think the state would approve that there be better means pre-trial.
Let me just ask once more.
Okay.
Should a motion, I'm not sure what the record says, but mm-hmm. let's suppose when the jury sends out that note mm-hmm. on the basis of the questionnaire and on the basis of the note, should the trial judge have granted a mistrial?
My answer to that question is that first of all, the court at that point didn't have the juror questionnaire. Nobody had the juror questionnaire in front of them showing that the person marked that he couldn't understand English. And secondly, and I've quoted the conversation in my brief, on page 5, that happened after the note was sent out. And I would say counsel acquiesced in not having that person brought out to voir dire, and at that point then there would be no basis without doing a voir dire to grant a mistrial. Nobody would have had any clue to whether the person had language difficulties. And thirdly, since after the fact there was an examination of this juror, it's sort of a moot point, because it's our contention the person had sufficient English comprehension to serve on the jury, so that if they had brought the juror out to do a voir dire, there would have been the same decision.
If a person cannot understand, if a person cannot comprehend narrative testimony, are they sufficiently qualified to serve as a juror?
I think the standard of comprehending narrative testimony, again, kind of begs the question too, because it doesn't give you any kind of level. There are all kinds of levels of understanding. You probably understand testimony better than I do, and I hopefully understand it better than somebody perhaps.
But comprehending the testimony rather than, I think of my own experience, and I dabble in the language of Spanish, and I can certainly get around in any Spanish-speaking country sufficiently to even carry on some conversations about the weather, politics, what's going on with the stores, but I would be woefully inadequate to serve as a juror, to have to sit there and listen to testimony. Your opposing counsel offers that as the standard, and that's why I ask you, if a person cannot comprehend narrative testimony, do they meet your standard of having sufficient understanding to serve as a juror in our system?
Again, I think tying it back to the comprehension of testimony is a dangerous thing to do, because if you're looking at it post-trial, it encourages people to ask the juror what they comprehended of the testimony, and that's not allowable. I think the standard needs to be vaguer than that. I think that it needs to give the discretion to the trial court to view the person, understand their level of comprehension, and who better than the trial court to know what kind of comprehension is necessary to serve on a jury in our system. And additionally, the stance of both our legislature and the cases throughout the country is that the level of comprehension has to be set very low. In the federal system, it is merely filling out the jury qualification questionnaire. In our statute has been revised over time to, in a sense, lower the level of English comprehension that you have to have and make the jury pool more diverse. In the earlier incarnations of our statute, they allowed for things like questioning jurors as to whether they're esteemed in the community. That has changed over time. At first, the statute read that you had to be able to read, write, and understand English. Then it was amended again to that you had to be able to read and understand, and currently it's understand English, which to me is an indication that the level of English comprehension that public policy in our state is a rather low level, and the reason for that is so that we have diverse people on our juries, and that no jury is a perfect jury, has a perfect understanding of everything that goes on. But and it's a group of people with various limitations, whether they be educational, cultural, physical, mental.
Yes, but
and
aren't we talking about what I would refer to as the competence, the qualifications to serve? Let me touch upon the sanctity of 906.06(2) as Justice Babbage was doing. If it came out during the course of the jury deliberations that someone, in a different sense, was incompetent, that they experienced an intense psychotic episode, the juror was going off the wall, is that testimony admissible? In a proceeding such as this,
I think if that can be gotten at through testimony other than the juror and through objective kind of information,
other jurors want to testify to that. I mean, that's who's in the jury room. The person is going through a psychotic episode. Is that person competent to serve on that jury?
I think that would not be allowable.
That would be testimony that, because of 906.06(2), you're saying.
Yeah.
If during the course of the deliberations it became clear that this person, this juror, was not a citizen of the United States and was not, had not yet attained the age of 18, 17 years old and non-citizen, would that information be able to be testified to by other jurors?
First of all, I don't think it would be necessary that the juror would have to testify to that. Those are objective things where there is other evidence that could prove that.
Would it be harmless error if a non-citizen or a 17-year-old sat?
There is a case, I think it's Weiss, that it wasn't non-citizen, but it was that a person was not the citizen of that county, and they did say that was harmless error.
Would you, if you were a defendant, want to be in front of a jury of 12 Tonys?
Of 12 what?
Of 12 Tonys.
I was not.
That's
unfair. It is. And I mean, it just brings to mind the question that I was not there when he was testifying. I don't know. It's a different question whether you can look at that cold record and say, yeah, Tony had difficulty answering those questions. He didn't give fluent answers. That's not the standard. There's a difference between what a person understands and how they speak. And he did speak in broken English, but that does not mean that he was not understanding the questions. The judge determined that he did. And the judge determined that he answered some sophisticated and understood some sophisticated questions.
Well, I want to get back to are we bound by the judge under the clearly erroneous findings of fact? I think we are. He found what the juror answered, etc. But basically, this is an attack that the defendant didn't get a fair trial. Basically, this is an attack that this standard of due process, whatever you want to call the standard, and however you want to phrase it, has not been met. That sounds like a question of constitutional fact, and that we review that de novo.
I don't believe that in this case that's appropriate. I believe this is more comparable to determining whether a person is subjectively biased or whether they're competent to stand trial, that it is such a fact-based decision. I don't find as convincing to me the actual specific findings of fact that the court did, whether he passed a test for driver's license or whether he had a job, or I don't think the court was as relying on those as much as their personal observation of this juror testifying and answering questions and the demeanor and the eye contact. And that's why it has to be, it's such a fact-based decision that it has to be a factual finding of whether a person has sufficient understanding to serve on the jury.
Make reference to subjective bias, but statutory bias.
Statutory bias is not this, and I'm sorry, I don't know exactly the standard of review, but it is not a
well. Statutory bias has nothing to do with whether the juror is impartial. It's a certain status relationship.
Right.
Are you related to a certain degree to one of the parties or something like that?
Right.
And I'm wondering if I were to make the suggestion that being unable to understand English is sort of equivalent to statutory bias, what would you say to that?
I think that's not appropriate because I think the understanding English, whether you're statutorily biased, there are some objective facts that you can look at and decide whether the person was in that kind of situation or had that kind of relationship. With respect to the understanding English, that is dependent on the judge observing the person and hearing the person, and you know that pretrial, the way this is going to all come about is that you're going to voir dire the person, or in, such as in Milwaukee, we'll have a system where people give a little narrative, each of the jurors gives a little narrative to decide whether they have sufficient English. So it's a very factual determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Prey. Mr. Miller?
Just have a couple of quick responses. First of all, I had promised a cite on the Tanner case in which it referred to a note, a jury note, and cited that with approval as a safeguard, and that was at 483 U.S. on page 127. I believe that was Justice Wilcox had asked about that. Secondly, Tanner does make an exception, or at least it doesn't rule out as an exception, fundamental incompetence. And Tanner states, and that's at page 125, 483 U.S. 125. And Tanner also does refer to Pellegrini, the case cited by the state. And I interpret that case differently than the state. It's interesting when I interpret a case to support my position and the state interprets the same case to support its position. Pellegrini denied relief. However, what the trial court, the district court in that case said was that there wasn't evidence of a significant difficulty in English to warrant relief, which suggests to me that if there was evidence of significant difficulty in English, then that would rise to the level of fundamental incompetence, and therefore there would be grounds for reversal. And so certainly to the extent that Tanner is far from clear on that point in terms of language, and I think a fairly compelling argument can be made that Tanner does not apply to a language case, and indeed, because we are dealing about fundamental incompetence when it comes to language. We're talking about whether the juror, you know, understands what is being said, it's kind of a threshold requirement in terms of evaluating the evidence. We can't get to an evaluation of the evidence until we've heard what the evidence is. The other point I wanted to make is on the federal, the state made a point about the federal jury questionnaire being the test for English comprehension, and I have never seen the federal jury questionnaire. I don't even know what that contains, but one thing that United States versus Pellegrini says in its decision is that that questionnaire form does require the juror to swear to his or her ability to understand English. And so to the extent that that questionnaire is being used to establish the juror's English credentials, I would point out that apparently upon penalty of something, the juror is required to swear to his or her English ability.
Are there any penalties for lying on a jury questionnaire in the state system?
Not that I'm aware of. I can't answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Okay. If I might just ask you a question, does the equipment you're using work?
It works fairly well. I'm getting some crackling, but it works well.
Better than without it?
Yeah, so absolutely. I don't get any echo or much clearer.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments on that. That concludes our hearing in 01-1136 CR State v. Carlson, and we are in recess until Tuesday morning, 9:45.